the president of the Arizona Board of Education is out after stepping down abruptly. But will his resignation end the battles between the Board of Ed and the Education Department?
It's disappointing that the situation became so difficult that this was the best possible solution that the leaders could see.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, want to buy a baseball stadium? Maricopa County could put its up for sale. A look at the well-being of Arizona's children.
The U of A hosts military veterans looking to go to college.
And what we can learn from dogs as we get older.
When their bodies are starting to shift and they are less able to do the things they once did, and they just did it.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein. The Valley forecast for this afternoon calling for cloudy skies with a high of 105 and a 50% chance of some more rain. That high, by the way, right around average for today. 30% chance of rain tonight, otherwise partly cloudy skies, overnight lows in the low to mid 80s. Partly sunny tomorrow with a high of 104. With relative humidity of 21%, it's 99 degrees.
A federal judge has ordered the release of photos from inside the U.S. Border Patrol's holding facilities in southern Arizona. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Tucson, Michelle Marisco reports that the photos are part of a class action lawsuit that was filed to pressure the agency to clean up the conditions within its holding cells.
The photos show a child crawling on the concrete floors of the holding cells while a parent squats nearby. In some images, men huddle beneath silvery mylar blankets intended for survival, not comfort. Another shows a mother changing a child's diaper on top of one of the blankets lying on the floor. Dora Preciado is an attorney with the National Immigration Law Center.
What we are asking the court is to ensure that, at a minimum, Border Patrol abides by its own meager standards.
Federal prosecutors have argued against releasing these images, and last year, the judge in the case accused the Border Patrol of purposefully destroying videotape recordings. The Border Patrol has declined comment, citing the pending litigation. Michelle Marisco, KJZZ News, Tucson.
The Arizona Board of Education will have a new president after Greg Miller resigned yesterday at the request of Governor Doug Ducey.
Miller and State Superintendent of Public Instruction Diane Douglas had a rocky relationship with featured disputes on a number of issues, as well as an accusation by Douglas that Miller assaulted her at a board meeting. The Maricopa County Attorney's Office ultimately declined to file charges. For his part, Miller agreed with the governor that there needed to be some kind of change.
She's the elected official. She's going to be there for another 2+ years. So I'm the expendable piece. She is not.
We have two perspectives today on what Miller's resignation could mean for the Board of Education going forward, as well as its relationship with the State Education Department. We start with Rebecca Gao, the Executive Director of Stand for Children Arizona. And Rebecca, what was your reaction when you heard about Miller's resignation?
Well, I just think it's a shame. I think he's been such a strong voice on things that many of us believe in: accountability, rigor, putting kids first. He's had a lot of experience in administrating for quality at the school level. He's been a strong voice on the board for a lot of really positive changes. And over the years that I've seen him on the board, he was always putting the kids first. And so it's disappointing that the situation became so difficult that this was the best possible solution that the leaders could see.
What kind of impact, if any, would you expect this change will have on education policy?
Well, the board is a relatively medium to large size board with a lot of different seats and representation. So having just one voice step down, even if it is the president, isn't going to change a whole lot, because it's just simply one vote that is no longer that same vote. And the expectation of the type of accountability and quality-minded person that the governor would appoint next, you know, hopefully will carry a lot of those positive qualities forward. So I don't know that it would change a whole lot in the short term, and it probably won't change a whole lot in the long term, other than he had a lot of really good experience and hopefully we'll have the same thing moving forward.
As you referenced, Governor Ducey will be appointing a replacement. Mm-hmm. What kind of person would you hope that he would be looking for to fill that spot?
Well, first, it's important to note that that spot is designated as a charter school administrator. So first of all, it has to be a charter school administrator. So I would hope that he would do what he's always done, which is look towards quality examples. I think that's key. Someone who has demonstrated a long-term understanding of education in Arizona, of what it takes to get to quality, and ideally someone who's worked with the low-income populations that make up half of the kids in our state.
From the outside, it appeared as though the dispute between Superintendent Diane Douglas and Greg Miller was almost a combination of personality conflict and policy conflict. With him gone, do you think that also resolves some of the policy conflicts that had been sort of simmering between the Board of Ed and the Department of Education?
Well, I think, as I mentioned before, he was just one person. I mean, the board voted in the majority on several different issues. They voted almost unanimously on many issues. They voted with almost everyone a majority and one in dissension on quite a few issues. So, again, the shifting of just one person doesn't change the vote counts. Hopefully what it does is change some of the drama that took the spotlight away from important discussions we need to have on quality and goals and having all the adults with a shared vision moving together for kids.
I mean, do you think that having Miller gone will sort of ease some of the tensions between the two entities?
I it's hard to say because, as my kids have often heard from me, it takes two. You know, it takes two, and it's going to continue to take all of the people on the board trying to work together.
Rebecca Gao is the executive director of Stanford Children Arizona.
Lisa Graham Keegan is a former superintendent of public instruction for Arizona. She opposed Diane Douglas's candidacy, but more recently has had some praise for the superintendent and her staff. Lisa, how impactful was the fracture relationship between Douglas and Greg Miller? Did it impact students and teachers, for example?
Anything that distracts you from the job at hand affects everybody, right? I mean, so I don't ever think any one person or two people can completely muck up the works. But it just, anything that prevents you from going forward at such an urgent time when we really are getting great gains in Arizona and there's lots of things we can be doing to move forward at the state board, anything that keeps you from doing that quickly is a problem. So, yeah, it had an effect, and I think that this will be a better environment now, I hope.
How important is the relationship in general between the superintendent and that department and what goes on at the Board of Education?
People need to be on the same page generally. For the role of the superintendent, the only power from a policy perspective that you have is in the state board, so it's all about the relationship there. And healthy disagreement is part of that job. You got a lot of people you're trying to work with, but it should be more about healthy discussion. And so it, really they rely on each other. She implements the policy. They set it, and they're all working with the law. And so it's an interesting dance, but the better everybody can be focused on larger principle, the better off the state's going to be.
It seems to a lot of us that Diane Douglas just hasn't been all that public. Is there anything we as the public can read into that, the fact that she's just not a very public figure at this point?
I think the superintendent is not a normally highly visible person, and she has her own approach. And I don't know what you read into that. I would only say that from our perspective and working with her staff and the leadership recently, they seem to be very focused on moving forward. They're reaching out a lot more than they have in the past. I appreciate it. It feels like a real effort to move ahead together with a lot of input. I know that's important to the superintendent. She spends a lot of time on the road talking to people, and I think that's a positive thing. And then you've got to be able to take that back and work collaboratively with your board. And so hopefully we're going to head into that period. I would think that will be a great thing.
What are some things that you're especially optimistic about, the progress you've seen? And what's another item or two that maybe there's been some progress, but you'd like to see more and you're seeing potential for it?
I think at the state board level, one of the most important things they're charged with is sort of setting the bar. So that's the standards themselves. What do we want our kids in Arizona to be learning? And obviously, that's been a point of discussion in Arizona. I do think that very quietly, that standards committee has been doing a pretty good job. And I think they're going to make some small but good corrections to what it is we ask our teachers to teach. The second issue is how we grade that then, A through F. There's a committee on that. I would love for that to be going a little bit faster than it is. We should be further down the pike because I think parents have a right to know how their schools are doing. I think we can do a better job in telling parents how their schools are performing, giving them a couple different data points, not just one.
That's former Arizona School Superintendent Lisa Graham Keegan.
Now, earlier today, Governor Ducey announced the appointment of two new members to the State Board of Education, Vail Unified School District Superintendent Calvin Baker and Janice Mack, who teaches STEM courses in the Paradise Valley Unified School District. Those appointments will fill already open seats on the board. They don't relate to Greg Miller's resignation. Governor Ducey could make that appointment at any time. Every election year, the Children's Action Alliance releases its Kids Count data book to take a look at how Arizona children are faring from poverty levels and safety to education and violent crime.
We need to know what the conditions are like for kids in Arizona and how we can do things better to improve what is in place and what sorts of public policies are going to make a difference for them.
That's Patty Urias with the Children's Action Alliance. She says there are some signs of improvement in our state, but Arizona still has a long way to go in protecting children. The show's Lauren Gilger took a deeper dive into some of what they found in this new report. And Lauren, what are some of the main takeaways?
So this is actually the second Kids Count report released this year. It takes a closer look at what's going on here in our state, down to the county level. The national Kids Count report was released in June, and that showed that Arizona ranks 45th in the country when it comes to conditions for kids. That's up from 46th last time. And Urias says one of the main concerns that came out of this report is that the rate of kids living in poverty has gotten much higher.
51%, so more than half of the kids in Arizona are in low-income families, and that's a concern because we know that there are a number of other factors that are affected by that particular benchmark.
Factors like educational attainment. The report found high school graduation rates have stalled, and there are low preschool participation rates here in Arizona.
Lauren, was it all bad news?
Actually, no. They've also found that the rate of young people arrested for violent crimes dropped by a third, and they found the number of babies born to mothers without a high school education went down in 12 of Arizona's 15 counties.
What's behind that?
So Urias says it has to do with the Great Recession. This report looks at 5 years of data from 2009 to 2014.
That five-year period is a snapshot of time during the economic recession and one of the worst recessions we've seen in our lifetimes, and then sort of slowly emerging from that recession. So it's a sign that a lot of families are considering what kind of a home am I going to be able to provide for a child.
And there's one more really important finding in here about foster care. They found the percentage of kids in foster care went up 87% in this five-year period. And Urias says that could have some serious long-term effects.
Foster care is not something to be taken lightly. It does impact a child's life in ways that are definitely very profound. So when you take a child out of the home and put them in foster care, then what happens with a lot of those kids is that they tend to struggle in school. They have difficulty adjusting to a normal life. Is there a way to prevent that or bring that number down by providing support services to families that would enable them to keep the children in the home?
Lauren, what kind of services is she talking about here?
Well, according to the Department of Child Safety, most reports to the Child Welfare Hotline are about neglect. So Urias says if our state spent more money on prevention services to help families, they might be able to keep their children at home. So, for example, Arizona's maximum unemployment insurance is the nation's third lowest, and K through 12 spending here is two-thirds the national average, according to the Children's Action Alliance. And they'd like to see a higher reimbursement rate for things like child care centers and more low-income working families benefiting from child care assistance.
That's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
And still to come on the show, what is up with the Diamondbacks and their stadium situation, and how unique is it? We'll find out coming up. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. Slight chance for showers and blowing dust tonight around the valley. Currently relative humidity at 21%, 99 degrees at 218.
KJZZ is supported by ASU Morrison Institute for Public Policy, hosting the Arizona Citizens Initiative Review, a voter education and engagement project for a better understanding of ballot measures. MorrisonInstitute.asu.edu.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, along with KJZZ's Phil Latzman.
And Mark, Aetna's announcement that it was pulling out of federal health care exchanges has left one Arizona county without an insurer of last resort.
That means about 10,000 residents of Pinal County currently don't have an option for 2017 under the Affordable Care Act, and that makes it the only county in the nation without access to that federal exchange for next year.
And joining us now is Pinal County Health Director Tom Schreier. You say you found out about the news that Aetna was leaving your county through the media?
Well, I think it's important to understand that in public health, the way it's constructed, I believe, across the country, we don't have a lot of interaction with those that regulate the insurance marketplace. And so we tend to get information after it's happened, and we're not usually consulted on what's going on. But we have viewed and obviously seen the trend of nationally and locally of less insurers participating in the marketplace. And so that's been something that's been on my radar as an area of concern. And then, of course, when I learned about it, I sent an email to the board supervisor saying, yeah, this is pretty significant. It's about 10,000 people impacted, plus, frankly, those that haven't been participating in the exchange that, you know, probably should, so they can take advantage of that benefit. But the idea of not having that benefit available potentially is scary.
How does that burden fall onto you as the public health director in Pinal County to try and fill that void? And you just mentioned there are almost 10,000 people that could be affected by this.
Well, I think realistically, honestly, I don't know how the county could fill that void. I mean, we tend to fill the void. You know, we're part of the safety net, and there are several safety nets in these systems that counties and states have for public health. And so we provide, you know, for instance, family practice or family planning services and immunizations and WIC services for nutrition. And those are all things that are part of the safety net. But we're not equipped to provide the primary care if your kid, you know, breaks their arm or those kinds of things. And I can't imagine how we would be funded to do something like that. We certainly aren't in the insurance business. So it's one of those areas, like many in public health, where this has a huge impact on the health of our residents, but in many ways we don't have a lot that we can do to influence it. I suspect they will resolve it, but it certainly does show the vulnerability of counties like mine, where we have high population growth. The healthcare system hasn't grown as rapidly as the population, and you know, frankly, a history of a lot of folks that are both unhealthy and uninsured that for the first time have had access to health insurance.
Well, Tom, it seems like Pinal County might be caught in sort of the middle of this political payback, with the CEO of Aetna telling the Justice Department that if you blocked our deal with Humana, that we'll drop out of Obamacare. How much of this do you think is political payback and that leaves your county without an exchange?
I have no idea. I'm just a public health director in a rural county, and I suspect if they could make money, they would make money in my county and in all the other counties that they're pulling out of.
Tom Schreier is director of public health in Pinal County, currently without a health care exchange under the Affordable Care Act. Good luck in getting that back, and thanks for your time, Tom.
Thank you.
Suzanne Feaster is president and CEO of Vitalist Health Foundation, a nonpartisan health policy foundation here in Phoenix, which has been helping uninsured Arizonans to sign up for the Affordable Care Act. So, Suzanne, what was your reaction to hearing that Aetna was pulling out of the state?
I was disappointed because Aetna in Arizona, Aetna's been a very good player and a good insurer. They've been deeply involved in the Medicaid products here with Mercy Care Plan. They're also deeply involved with the Mercy Maricopa. So in our state, Aetna has been a good and active insurer, both involved in the community and involved with people who are underinsured. And so it was disappointing. And obviously this was a lot bigger issue than Arizona.
A lot of reports out there that this decision may have been made by Aetna because their merger with Humana was called off by the Justice Department, and in this some way could be retribution or political payback to the Obama administration. Do you buy into that?
Well, I'm not going to speculate. I know even on your national news, you've heard the stories, and that Huffington Post broke the information and the letter that was sent. So I think it'll be important for Aetna to explain what they meant and why they've done this. There's no question that this is a political time. We are in a very robust political season. And so it's hard not to think there weren't some political overtones, simply because the Affordable Care Act every once in a while pops up in commercials, political commercials, and in the political dialogue.
If we take Aetna at its word when they say they just weren't making enough money and there just weren't enough healthy people that were signing up and too many sick people that were signing up for these plans, it was costing them too much money. How do we solve that problem of trying to get the pool a little more balanced?
I think this is an enormous change in our system. And when the Congress approved Medicaid and Medicare in 1966 and 65, almost every other year there were major changes on the congressional level to fine-tune it. And it didn't start out really well either. And Arizona was the very last state to join Medicaid. Although it was approved in 65, we didn't join until 1981. So this is, again, a very large change. And I think there are certain areas that need to be fixed. So our hope, and we will be working toward that, is to sort of shine the light on where improvements could be made and then try and work on a bipartisan nature to get those changes addressed.
Suzanne Feaster is with the Vitalist Health Foundation here in Phoenix. Thank you so much for your time.
Yes, glad to help.
So, Phil, what happens next?
Well, everybody, Mark, believes this will be resolved. Tom Trier in Pinal County, who we just heard from, says the Blue Cross Blue Shield is one of the companies they're in active negotiations with to lure back into the marketplace to replace Aetna to serve those 10,000 potentially uninsured people. But while Pinal is the first to have this problem, it certainly may not be the last if these health exchanges continue to fall apart.
And that's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Thanks, Phil.
You got it, Mark.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Car wash, $6.
I'm Alyssa Farrell, and we're having a car wash down here at the Miracle-E. There was a car that had just been to Flagstaff, so they've got bugs all over their car. Oh, jeez. And I'm short, so it's really hard to get the really big cars. I have a little brother who's in a wheelchair, and so Miracle League is very close to me because he's been out here and he plays, and it's the highlight of his week. Yeah, your car's ready.
Okay. Thank you. Good job.
And so the money that we're making from the car wash just kind of helps to keep this place open and running so that people can still have that like awesome day where they can come out and play baseball with their friends.
That's Alyssa Farrell helping out with the charity car wash. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just think we could use a new wax coating, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. It's not quite strike three for the Diamondbacks and their relationship with Maricopa County, but the Stadium District's Board of Directors has voted unanimously to sign a letter of intent to sell Chase Field. The Diamondbacks' home field could end up being owned by Integral Group LLC if the process moves forward. Neil DeMoss, author of the book Field of Schemes, follows stadium plans and disputes across the country and joins me. Neil, how unique is this situation?
It's the first time I can recall anyone trying to sell a stadium to a third party. I guess what doesn't make sense to me isn't so much having someone who isn't either the team or the local government own it. I mean, you know, there's no reason not to have a private manager for a stadium. And in fact, you know, there are plenty of stadiums that are owned by public entities and are run by, you know, some private management company. So that's not so odd. What's odd to me is thinking that anybody's going to be able to make money on this deal, right? Because that's what you're fighting over. It's not about whether or not to build a stadium in the first place. It's about how to get out of this this lease battle. And, you know, I don't know what there is in owning Chase Field but not owning all the revenues from the Diamondbacks that would cause a private firm to want to invest $60 million in this.
Beyond, let's say, Fenway Park, Wrigley Field, and AT&T Park in San Francisco, I'm sure I'm leaving out a couple. What makes a quote-unquote successful baseball stadium now as far as size, as far as the offerings? I mean, are there certain places doing it better than others?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two ways to have a successful stadium. One is to build it in a place that is just so flush with money that you can't help but make money, or, you know, make money out, or at least make everybody whole, right? And that the example of that would be with the in football with the San Francisco 49ers, right, where they built it in Silicon Valley, and there's just so much money floating around that they're able to pay off the costs, and, you know, Santa Clara isn't going to be on the hook, and the 49ers are making money as well. Really, the best way to make money on having a stadium is to have the stadium already built and paid for, right? So when you're talking about places like Fenway Park or Wrigley Field, sure, they're doing upgrade work on them, but, you know, the fact that the initial debt is already paid off makes it so much easier to make money. That's one of the reasons that I'm sort of puzzled by this whole process, and I think it's concerning to be talking about, you know, either major upgrades to Chase Field or you know, even there's been talk about replacing it, is, you know, once you've actually built the thing, whatever you think of the original investment in the stadium, you know, that's when you can start saying, okay, fine, the bonds are paid off. Now we can actually, you know, talk about an equitable deal. And it seems like instead of that, the Diamondbacks owners are kind of upping the ante of like, oh, you know, now that you've paid for this thing, when can we get a new one?
Neil, finally, are we at a stage where it is less likely that a team can, to use a harsher term, blackmail a city into getting what it wants, in other ways, negotiating to get what it wants, to say, almost to threaten, we're going to move to another city? Is that a less common possibility now? And is that making some of these government entities or folks who serve in government feeling a little bit more comfortable and saying, hey, we're not going to give you what you want because you're not going to find another city that will either?
You know, I think the move threat has always been mostly a bluff, you know, and the, you know, the history of sports is littered with owners who, as Jerry Reinsdorf did when he was trying to get a new stadium for the White Sox in Chicago and flew down to Tampa Bay, which at the time didn't have a team, and then flew back and later was asked, were you really going to move the White Sox? And he said, no, but a savvy negotiator creates leverage. Team owners have always done that, and I think what's happening now is, you know, less that the threat is less viable and more that a few elected officials are starting to smarten up. You know, I mean, there's at this point 30 years of, you know, economic studies showing that there's zero or as close to zero as is mathematically possible economic benefit from building a new sports stadium.
Neil DeMoss is co-author of the book Field of Schemes. He's also the man behind the website fieldofschemes.com. And Neil, good to talk with you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Always my pleasure.
Coming up, the U of A hosts some Warrior Scholars. That story's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5. He's Steve. I'm Mark. Quickly checking Valley traffic. A number of accidents in around the same area. I-10 eastbound at 7th Avenue. I-10 eastbound at the 51. 202 westbound, the Red Mountain Freeway, also at the 51. And I-10 eastbound at Van Buren. We have a 50% chance of getting some more rain today across the valley. It'll be a high of 105. 30% chance of rain tonight. Overnight lows in the low to mid 80s. It's sunny and 102 degrees at KJZZ at 233.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, celebrating the Subaru A Lot to Love event, presenting the 2017 Subaru Legacy, the 34 MPG midsize sedan redefined. Ready now for test drives. Shop Subaru.com.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The State Department says it held up a $400 million cash payment to Iran until American prisoners were released in January. The U.S. still says it wasn't a ransom payment, but did use the money as leverage, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The way the administration explains it, there were a lot of moving parts over a 24-hour period in January. The U.S. was trying to get several American prisoners out of Iran and clear an old financial claims case. State Department spokesman John Kirby says the money, an initial $400 million in cash, was held up until the prisoners were airborne.
We, of course, sought to retain maximum leverage until after American citizens were released. That was our top priority.
The Obama administration announced the payment back in January, but the timing of the flights is something new, first reported Wednesday by The Wall Street Journal. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton says the divide between police and communities around the country needs to be eliminated. Speaking to law enforcement in New York today, Clinton said it won't be easy to repair the distrust that many communities have for police.
We have to be clear-eyed about the challenges we face. We can't ignore them, and certainly we must not inflame them. We need to work together to bridge our divides, not stoke even more divisiveness.
Clinton says both sides benefit when there is mutual respect. Republican nominee Donald Trump is in North Carolina today, where he met with the Fraternal Order of Police. Louisiana could be facing its biggest housing crisis since Hurricane Katrina a decade ago. About 40,000 homes already have been damaged by record flooding. People are staying in shelters, bunking with friends or relatives, or even sleeping in trailers on their front lawns. FEMA is trying to set up rental properties for those left homeless. Stocks finished higher on Wall Street. This is NPR.
And in a check of international news on KJZZ at 2:35, despite falling out of the headlines, the migration to Europe continues. And as countries like France have closed their borders in an attempt to fight terrorism, people end up stuck.
Earlier this month, some 300 migrants, mainly from African countries, forced their way through a checkpoint on the border between Italy and France before French police rounded them up and sent them back to a city on the Italian side. The Italians have been struggling to prevent an Italian version of Calais, the French Channel port now infamous for its migrant camps. The BBC's John Lawrenson reports.
I arrive in Ventimiglia early in the morning, looking for the church where many migrants are said to be staying, and end up at the wrong one. I get talking to a man called Cesare, who turns out to be the church warden. Like many Italians in this border town, he speaks French. Yes, he has something to say about the immigrati, but it's way off the Pope Francis' message of universal love that I was expecting.
Tous ces gens-là, ils dormaient ici, à la gare.
Things were very bad here a few weeks ago. At one point, the Red Cross were handing out up to 3,000 meals a day. There were so many people sleeping at the station just behind this church that passengers couldn't go onto the platforms. And at the car park next door, where there were no facilities at all, people ate, slept and defecated all in the same place. And the paper tins and bottles from the food they received, they just dropped on the ground. Some of them came into the church. They used to gather by the statues, but they were just charging up their mobile phones. I chucked them all out.
Down on the beach, set back a little from the holidaymakers, there's a group of Afghans huddled in the shade of a palm tree, sleeping, killing time before making another attempt to cross the border tonight. In the park and near the station, I meet another Afghan, a Pakistani, and a few groups of Africans from the French-speaking West and the more English-speaking Horn of Africa. But the scenes Cesare described have been stopped. The authorities didn't want a Calais-style jungle camp springing up among the tourists on the Italian Riviera. And at the end of July, the prefetto, the man in charge of law and order, opened an official migrant camp in a disused rail freight yard outside the town and put the Red Cross in charge of it. I finally find the church that has thrown open its doors to the migrants. It's under a flyover on the outskirts. Women are tidying the dormitory where several dozen women and children sleep on mattresses in the church basement. The people I talk to here all want to go to France. Mujayet, for example, who's from Sudan.
I speak English. I want to learn English
you know.
So you want to live in the UK?
I hope that. Mm-hmm. I hope that.
Have you tried to cross the border to France?
I try, but they took you and send you back far away, you know. Mm.
Where did they send you back to?
Taranto.
Where's that?
I don't know. They took our fingerprint and I don't know why.
3 miles up the road is the new Red Cross camp, made out of shipping containers, Calais style. There are only single men in this camp. I chat for a while with some from Sudan, Libya and Cameroon. The Libyan man has a leg in a plaster cast. A French policeman did that to him before kicking him out of France, he claims. From the Red Cross camp, you can look up at the towering Alps from where Napoleon's army once came streaming down to take the Italians by surprise. The French recently began troop patrols up there to arrest migrants taking to the mountain passes. For now, at least, the Italians have put an end to the squalor of jungle-style squatter camps. But the build-up of migrants behind the border is not about to go away. Ventimiglia is getting used to being Italy's Calais.
The BBC's John Lawrenson.
The University of Arizona this month hosted military veterans as part of the National Warrior Scholar Project. It's described as a college prep academic boot camp for enlisted military vets who want to go back to college. The group partners with 12 universities across the country, including U of A. Sid Ellington is the executive director of the Warrior Scholar Project. And Sid, what are the veterans learning about during their sessions?
What the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines learn is really threefold. Firstly, we teach what we're going to call strategic level skills, but that's your high level skill building that enlisted veterans, 64% of whom are first generation college students. So that's like analytic reading, seminar participation, college level writing. Secondly, we teach what I'm going to call tactical level skill building. So that's objective number two. And that's study skills, time management. It's how to break apart a syllabus, note taking. Thirdly, we teach and we help with transitions.
What are some of the biggest challenges that you've heard from military members as far as transitioning from the military into a university setting?
Surprisingly, many of the challenges that enlisted veterans face are things that you wouldn't really think about off the top of your head. Time management is a big one. But then if you think a little bit harder about it or drill a little bit deeper, that kind of makes sense because folks have been told where to be, what time to be there, and what uniform to wear. So suddenly they get onto a college campus and they have, you know, the time management's totally on them. So time management's a big one. The other one is what we'll call, you know, researchers refer to as the imposter syndrome. That's like, okay, I'm not real sure what I'm doing, but here I am. They must have made a mistake in admitting me into this college. Everybody here is smarter than me. I'm not sure if I can do it. So it's a lack of confidence. They may be very, very confident in the skills and the job that they have in the military, and once they take that uniform off, there's a lot of self-doubt that comes into play.
What was it about the University of Arizona that led you to want to expand to this school?
First of all, Arizona is a great state for veterans. Many, many veterans choose Arizona as a place to be once their military service is over. So there's a huge veteran footprint in the state of Arizona. Secondly, the school itself reached out to us and was so supportive in our efforts and opened their arms, figuratively speaking, to bring us, you know, onto the campus. Thirdly, the University of Arizona is participating in this undergraduate STEM initiative that's being spearheaded by the Association of American Universities based out of Washington, D.C. So given that Warrior Scholar Project A would love to be in a state at a flagship campus where there are a lot of military veterans that choose that as their post-military home, B, that Warrior Scholar Project is starting to expand in the area of STEM. So we thought that Arizona would be a good place to start with a humanities program and then grow in the area of STEM for 2017. So it just, on many levels, the University of Arizona seemed like a great partner for our work.
Sid Ellington is the executive director of the Warrior Scholar Project, which this year added the University of Arizona. Sid, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. It is men who are in U.S. prisons mostly, but today women are the fastest growing segment of inmates in this system, primarily designed for men.
The Vera Institute of Justice and the Safety and Justice Challenge found in a new report that the number of women behind bars has increased 14-fold in a little over four decades, with approximately 110,000 women now incarcerated.
It's a predominantly African-American and Hispanic population. Most are poor. Nearly 80% are mothers, and 22% have serious mental illness, which is double the rate of jailed men. Most are incarcerated for low-level, nonviolent crimes, often committed to support a drug habit or addiction. The Vera Institute study finds that jails are ill-equipped to deal with the challenges of women in the justice system. And that's the experience of former inmate Renia Angel Farmer, an exceptional case. She's seen it all. Now she's a speaker and facilitator at Let's Start, a program dedicated to assisting women in transition from prison life to society in St. Louis, Missouri. Renia, welcome.
Hello.
110,000 women are incarcerated today, and I suspect that almost all of them have family issues of one kind or another, specialized health issues that the prison was not originally designed to serve. How badly does the criminal justice system fall short in some of these categories?
It falls short, definitely, number one, in the medical field. They hire doctors who have got fired from their practices from the outside, and they come in, continue to work as a fired doctor to try to help inmates. And you literally, I've seen a lot of women die, literally, at my feet due to lack of knowledge, due to just not caring. And you literally got to be half dead to even get a ride to the hospital, you know, put it like that. They try to do everything right in that little vicinity that they have with a minimal amount of work or tools that they need. And it's just not healthy at all.
What about family issues, women with children, women who even find themselves pregnant at the time of incarceration?
Well, if they're pregnant, God help them. They're literally got to be like 7 or 8 centimeter, you know, dilation before they even take them out of the building. But they still have to sleep on the same steel bunk beds, things like that. But as far as those of us with children there, the program Let's Start, when I was there, they helped a lot in bringing my children from St. Louis all the way up to Vandalia, a two-hour drive, so that I can have these visits with my children, because my family wasn't traveling that far. They figured, hey, you made that bed, lay in it, and I get it, I understand it. But had it not been for Let's Start, I wouldn't have saw my children or my pastor.
Do you think nationally the criminal justice system is ready for this 14-fold increase in four decades and the continuing increase in women inmates and all of the issues that you've described here that increase brings?
They're not ready and they're not equipped. They don't have enough staff for that. You only have to have a eighth grade education to work in the prison system. Some of them are intimidated by those who have college degrees, and that can cause a targeting in the prison system. I've seen that. How smart you are and how smart they aren't, you know, could cause a problem. But because they carry the badge, then there's a constant confrontation right there.
What do you think the impact of mental illness is among the female prison population? And are the facilities that you know about and have experience with come close to dealing with that?
They don't deal with the mental population, I believe. The women that I've seen, they're more medicated than dealt with. They'll come in, and I've went and talked to some of these people. I pretty much was curious about what was going on because I wanted to find out about PTSD, wanted to find out about schizophrenia, schizophrenia affective and major depression. These aren't things that we talked about in a quote-unquote black household, but these were things that were taking place. And so I needed to know, I needed a root definition of what was going on, what was needed, what needed to be done. And the prison system, it definitely wasn't. You may, out of 10, you may have one, maybe two people that were qualified to kind of help you, and all they can do is talk. But mostly they medicate them. They would rather medicate them to keep from pretty much dealing with them. And so I watched a lot of women walk around not even knowing that there's an existence because they're so medicated. And that's not a healthy help, you know. They put these labels on them, these mental labels on them. And yes, they are true, but there has to be something more than just blocking them out.
You are a speaker and facilitator at Let's Start. You're an activist for the prison population that you were once a part of. And clearly you've taken steps to begin a life outside of prison. But in general, what is the American population going to receive back into communities from what's being done or not done with the inmates that you see in this growing female inmate population?
Some do go in and come out without, you know, having to go back down that road. Some it takes 5, 6, 7, 8 times going back and forth. But most of it is definitely a mindset. If you said, hey, I'm going to come home. I'm going to be the best person I can be. I'm not going to live up to the standards that, you know, if you're told you'll never be nothing, you'll never amount to anything, you'll start to believe that. But until you change how you think, that's a part of keeping you one step out of the penitentiary.
Rania Farmer, can I call you Angel?
Yes.
All right. Thanks so much. Angel Farmer is a speaker and facilitator at Let's Start in St. Louis, Missouri. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
And good Thursday afternoon. You're listening to the show on 91.5. I'm Steve with Mark. 30% chance for rain and dust tonight around the valley. Currently, it's mostly sunny, 102 degrees at 251.
KJZZ is supported by El Choro, Paradise Valley's historic destination dining experience. You can enjoy cocktails, seasonal cuisine, and patio views of Camelback Mountain. Details at elchoro.com.
A new spectrograph is coming to Kitt Peak National Observatory near Tucson. The Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, or DESI, just got formal approval from the U.S. Energy Department. It'll help answer some long-standing questions about the universe's expansion, among other things. With me to explain is Risa Wexler. She's a professor at Stanford and one of the spokespeople for this project. And Risa, what exactly are you going to be looking at and looking for?
So our main goal with this project is to understand more about this crazy thing that we call dark energy, which is something that we think makes up a large fraction of the universe and is actually causing the universe's expansion rate to speed up with time.
And you'll be doing that by looking at light in outer space, is that right?
Absolutely. So what DESI is actually going to do is a survey of about 35 million galaxies and quasars in the universe, and in addition to that, about 10 million stars within our own galaxy, the Milky Way. And we're building a new instrument, a spectrograph, which uses new technology so that we can actually get this many spectra. So it's about 10 times more spectra than have ever been taken by any telescope.
So how do you take what you'll see and extrapolate that to determine whether or not the universe is expanding, at what rate, and learn more about dark matter? Like, how does that all work?
What we are actually measuring is the positions and distances of these 35 million objects. So before DESI starts taking data, we actually will take images of the sky. We will be observing about a third of the entire sky. And so before DESI starts, we will be taking pictures pictures of this, but the images just give us a 2D picture. And what DESI will do is turn that 2D picture into a 3D map of what the universe looks like, essentially over the last 10 billion years.
And ultimately, what will that tell us? I mean, how practically will scientists use that information?
Right. So what we're actually trying to do is measure two things. One is the expansion history of the universe, essentially how fast is the universe expanding with time? And the second thing is how fast do structures grow in the universe? So how do we go from the relatively smooth universe we had 13 billion years ago to the very clumpy and clustered distribution of galaxies that we have today? So DESI will be able to make both of those measurements, and those two measurements actually can tell us about what is the physics that is causing the accelerating universe and what is the universe made of. It will tell us something about, it will really allow us to test our theories of what is doing that acceleration.
This project will ultimately result in a 3D map of the sky, basically. Do you have any expectation of what that will look like?
Yeah, we actually have very good expectations of what it will look like in general. You know, we have previous measurements, of about a tenth of this size, so not probing nearly as much volume. But in addition to that, one of the things we can do is we can use our current theories of how the universe evolves and what it's made of to simulate essentially exactly what we expect this survey should look like. And that's one of the things that my group does in particular. You know, we have a very good idea of what it looks like qualitatively, but quantitatively, DESI will be making very, very precise measurements that will actually allow us to test our theories of dark energy at much, much higher precision than we can today.
Is there anything in particular that you are very excited to see or find out about this project?
Oh, there's so many things. I mean, I think the first thing is just that we will really be able to test these theories that we have at significantly higher precision than we can today. And so, you know, whenever you have new discovery space, it's just been shown that we often make new discoveries. So to me, that's one of the most exciting things, is just that opportunity for discovery.
Risa Wexler is a professor at Stanford and a spokesperson for the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument. Risa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It may be true that you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but humans may be able to learn a lot from senior dogs, including how to deal with aging. In her book, Senior Dogs Across America, photographer Nancy Levine includes pictures of pooches as old as 21, or 147 to you and me, from coast to coast. Some of the dogs are still working on ranches or farms, while others are just curled up on the couch. And Nancy Levine joins me to talk about senior dogs. Nancy, when you're a human who's aged along with your dog over the course of a dozen years or more, can you describe what that feels like?
I can sort of put myself in their place a lot more viscerally as my Lulu and Maxie were growing older than perhaps I did with Babe, who was my first dog that I saw through. Either way, it's a quality that I definitely learned from in the way they age, the way they truly stay in the present. When their bodies are starting to shift and they are less able to do the things they once did, and they just did it.
Was there a dynamic that seemed to be a collective quality that these senior dogs had?
Some were very fragile and some were much stronger. I think it's like humans. They age like humans do. Some, you can meet a person in their 80s and they are vibrant and doing everything, and then somebody else in their 80s might be much more fragile. And it's the same case with dogs. I think what's palpable and what's so wonderful in being a dog, if they're in a loving home, is all of the people that attended to these dogs were so sensitive and conscious of the needs of their dogs. So there's this sort of palpable love that moves back and forth, and such an implicit trust.
Do you think we as humans could consciously learn from how dogs age and apply it to ourselves?
We think too much, and we stress ourselves out a lot. We can become, I think, more scared in some ways because of the projections we're capable of making of where we're headed. Whereas a dog doesn't do that. If a dog has a great person living, who the dog is living with, The relationship is so pure and so stress-free. It's a very comforting time as well, I think. Whereas with people, oftentimes there's just can be more emotional dynamics flying around, and sometimes that can be more difficult for a person who's aging. And for a dog, if the dog has a great person, it can be just a very calm experience, I guess one could say.
At what stage did you, as an artist, know that you had the subjects you wanted, you found the right dogs for, and you had taken the photos that you thought got the point across?
There were different aspects that related to a dog's ability to communicate with the camera. For example, when I do mostly assignment work, I photograph people mostly. I photograph a lot of children at Seattle Children's Hospital. So when I'm photographing people, and I'm doing even portraits of people, there are some people, you probably might recognize this yourself, when you see a powerful portrait, it's the photographer's ability to bring forth something really deep and thoughtful from the person that they're photographing. Something about the person they're photographing through their eyes, through the gestures of their face or their body language conveys something that is really thought-provoking and very moving, and people would tend to regard that as a really superb portrait. It's the same with dogs. There were many dogs who I adored, loved, enjoyed photographing, but their ability to communicate all of those layers of emotion was not as significant as other dogs that really came forth.
Is there something in there that could speak to someone who's not a dog lover?
I think it's just a really profound question. And it doesn't just speak to dogs, it speaks to the animal kingdom at large. One of the motivations in doing a book like this and making sure I edit the images to convey a sense of meaningful depth to each of these dogs is to alter, and sometimes maybe just small ways, people's understanding that animals, dogs in particular in this case, do share the planet with us.
Photographer Nancy Levine. We've been talking about her new book, Senior Dogs Across America.
And make sure you're with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 for the show. The Goldwater Institute is taking aim at an East Valley City's sign code and one orchestra with instruments from many, many countries. Those stories and much more tomorrow at 2 on the show.
And that's all for today's edition of the show here on 91.5. We'd like to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. We're at the show at kjzz.org. All Things Considered is up next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks very much for listening. It's 3 o'clock.